Chapter 16. The news as to the identity of the body lying now in Almayer's compound spread rapidly over the settlement. During the forenoon, most of the inhabitants remained in the long street discussing the mysterious return and the unexpected death of the man who had become known to them as the traitor. His arrival during the northeast monsoon, his long sojourn in their midst, his sudden departure with his brig, and, above all, the mysterious appearance of the body, said to be his, amongst the logs, were subjects to wonder at and to talk over and over again with undiminished interest. Mamat moved from house to house, and from group to group, always ready to repeat his tale. How he saw the body caught by the sarong in a forked log. How Mrs. Almayer coming, one of the first, at his cries, recognized it, even before he had it hauled on shore. How Babalichai ordered him to bring it out of the water. Why the feet I dragged him in, and there was no head, exclaimed Mamat, and how could the white man's wife know who it was? She was a witch, it was well known. And did you see how the white man himself ran away at the sight of the body? Like a deer he ran. And here Mamat imitated Almayer's long strides, to the great joy of the beholders. And for all his trouble he had nothing. The ring with the green stone too in Babalichai kept. Owing. Nothing. He spat down at his feet in sign of disgust, and left that group to seek further on a fresh audience. The news spreading to the furthermost parts of the settlement found out Abdullah in the cool recess of his godown, where he sat overlooking his Arab clerks, and the men loading and unloading the upcountry canoes. Rashid, who was busy on the jetty, was summoned into his uncle's presence and found him, as usual, very calm and even cheerful, but very much surprised. The rumor of the capture or destruction of Dane's brig had reached the Arab's ears 3 days before from the sea fishermen, and through the dwellers on the lower reaches of the river. It had been passed upstream from neighbor to neighbor till Bulangi, whose clearing was nearest to the settlement, had brought that news himself to Abdullah, whose favor he courted. But rumor also spoke of a fight, and of Dane's death on board his own vessel. And now all the settlement talked of Dane's visit to the Raja, and of his death, when crossing the river in the dark to see Almayer. They could not understand this. Rashid thought that it was very strange. He felt uneasy and doubtful. But Abdullah, after the first shock of surprise, with the old age's dislike for solving riddles, showed a becoming resignation. He remarked that the man was dead now at all events, and consequently no more dangerous. Where was the use, to wonder at the decrees of fate, especially if they were propitious to the true believers? And with a pious ejaculation to Allah the Merciful, the Compassionate, Abdullah seemed to regard the incident as closed for the present. Not so Rashid. He lingered by his uncle, pulling thoughtfully his neatly trimmed beard. There are many lies, he murmured. He has been dead once before, and came to life to die again now. The Dutch will be here before many days and clamor for the man. Shall I not believe my eyes sooner than the tongues of women and idle men? They say that the body is being taken to Almayer's compound, said Abdullah. If you want to go there you must go before the Dutch arrive here. Go late. It should not be said, that we have been seen inside that man's enclosure lately. Rashid assented to the truth of this last remark and left his uncle's side. He leaned against the lintel of the big doorway, and looked idly across the courtyard through the open gate onto the main road of the settlement. It lay empty, straight, and yellow under the flood of light. In the hot noontide the smooth trunks of palm trees, the outlines of the houses, and away there at the other end of the road the roof of Almayer's house visible over the bushes on the dark background of forest, seemed to quiver in the heat radiating from the steaming earth. Swarms of yellow butterflies rose, and settled to rise again in short flights before Rashid's half-closed eyes. From under his feet, arose the dull hum of insects in the long grass of the courtyard. He looked on sleepily. From one of the side paths amongst the houses a woman stepped out on the road, a slight girlish figure walking under the shade of a large tray balanced on its head. The consciousness of something moving stirred Rishit's half-sleeping senses into a comparative wakefulness. He recognized Tamina, Bulanji's slave girl, with her tray of cakes for sale, an apparition of daily recurrence, and of no importance whatever. She was going towards Almayer's house. She could be made useful. He roused himself up, and ran towards the gate calling out, "Tamina, oh!" The girl stopped, hesitated, and came back slowly. Rishit waited, signing to her impatiently to come near. When near Rishit, Tamina stood with downcast eyes. Rishit looked at her a while, before he asked, "Are you going to Almayer's house? They say in the settlement, that Dane the traitor, he that was found drowned this morning, is lying in the white man's campong." "I have heard this talk," whispered Tamina, "and this morning by the riverside I saw the body. Where it is now I do not know." "So you have seen it?" asked Rishit, eagerly. "Is it Dane? You have seen him many times. You would know him." The girl's lips quivered, and she remained silent for a while, breathing quickly. "I have seen him, not a long time ago," she said at last. "He talk is true. He is dead. What do you want from me, Tuan?" "I must go." Just then the report of the gun fired on board the steam launch was heard, interrupting Rishit's reply. Leaving the girl, he ran to the house, and met in the courtyard Abdullah coming towards the gate. "The Orang Bland are come," said Rishit, "and now we shall have our reward." Abdullah shook his head doubtfully. "He white men's rewards are long in coming," he said. "White men are quick in anger and slow in gratitude. We shall see." He stood at the gate stroking his gray beard and listening to the distant cries of greeting at the other end of the settlement. As Tamina was turning to go, he called her back. "Listen, girl," he said, "Colin, there will be many white men in Almayer's house. You shall be there selling your cakes to the men of the sea. What you see, and what you hear, you may tell me. Come here before the sun sets, and I will give you a blue handkerchief with red spots. Now go, and forget not to return." He gave her a push with the end of his long staff as she was going away, and made her stumble. "This slave is very slow," he remarked to his nephew, looking after the girl with great disfavor. Tamina walked on, her tray on the head, her eyes fixed on the ground. From the open doors of the houses were heard, as she passed, friendly calls inviting her within for business purposes, but she never heeded them, neglecting her sales in the preoccupation of intense thinking. Since the very early morning she had heard much, she had also seen much that filled her heart with a joy mingled with great suffering and fear. Before the dawn, before she left Bulanji's house to paddle up to Sambar, she had heard voices outside the house, when all in it but herself were asleep. And now, with her knowledge of the words spoken in the darkness, she held in her hand a life, and carried in her breast a great sorrow. Yet from her springy step, erect figure, and face veiled over by the everyday look of apathetic indifference, nobody could have guessed of the double load she carried under the visible burden of the tray piled up high with cakes manufactured by the thrifty hands of Bulanji's wives. And that supple figure, straight as an arrow, so graceful and free in its walk, behind those soft eyes, that spoke of nothing but of unconscious resignation, there slept all feelings and all passions, all hopes and all fears, the curse of life and the consolation of death. And she knew nothing of it all. She lived like the tall palms amongst whom she was passing now, seeking the light, desiring the sunshine, fearing the storm, unconscious of either. The slave had no hope, and knew of no change. She knew of no other sky, no other water, no other forest, no other world, no other life. She had no wish, no hope, no love, no fear except of a blow, and no vivid feeling, but that of occasional hunger, which was seldom, for Bulanji was rich, and rice was plentiful in the solitary house in his clearing. The absence of pain and hunger was her happiness, and when she felt unhappy she was simply tired, more than usual, after the day's labor. Then in the hot nights of the southwest monsoon she slept dreamlessly under the bright stars on the platform built outside the house, and over the river. Inside they slept too. Bill and I by the door, his wives further in, the children with their mothers. She could hear their breathing, Bulangi's sleepy voice, the sharp cry of a child soon hushed with tender words. And she closed her eyes to the murmur of the water below her, to the whisper of the warm wind above, ignorant of the never-ceasing life of that tropical nature that spoke to her in vain with the thousand faint voices of the near forest, with the breath of tepid wind, in the heavy scents that lingered around her head, in the white wraiths of morning mist that hung over her in the solemn hush of all creation before the dawn. Such had been her existence before the coming of the brig with the strangers. She remembered well that time, the uproar in the settlement, the never-ending wonder, the days and nights of talk and excitement. She remembered her own timidity with the strange men, till the brig moored to the bank, became in a manner part of the settlement, and the fear wore off in the familiarity of constant intercourse. The call on board then became part of her daily round. She walked hesitatingly up the slanting planks of the gangway amidst the encouraging shouts, and more or less decent jokes of the men idling over the bulwarks. There she sold her wares to those men that spoke so loud, and carried themselves so free. There was a throng, a constant coming and going, calls interchanged, orders given and executed with shouts, the rattle of blocks, the flinging about of coils of rope. She sat out of the way under the shade of the awning, with her tray before her, the veil drawn well over her face, feeling shy amongst so many men. She smiled at all buyers, but spoke to none, letting their jests pass with stolid unconcern. She heard many tales told around her of far-off countries, of strange customs, of events stranger still. Those men were brave, but the most fearless of them spoke of their chief with fear. Often the man they called their master passed before her, walking erect and indifferent, in the pride of youth, in the flash of rich dress, with a tinkle of gold ornaments, while everybody stood aside watching anxiously for a movement of his lips, ready to do his bidding. Then all her life seemed to rush into her eyes, and from under her veil she gazed at him, charmed, yet fearful to attract attention. One day he noticed her and asked, "Who is that girl?" "Slave, Tuan. A girl that sells cakes," a dozen voices replied together. She rose in terror to run on shore when he called her back, and as she stood trembling with head hung down before him, he spoke kind words, lifting her chin with his hand and looking into her eyes with a smile. "Oh, not be afraid," he said. He never spoke to her anymore. Somebody called out from the river bank. He turned away and forgot her existence. Tamina saw Almayer standing on the shore with Nina on his arm. She heard Nina's voice calling out gaily, and saw Dane's face brighten with joy as he leaped on shore. She hated the sound of that voice ever since. After that day she left off visiting Almayer's compound, and passed the noon hours under the shade of the brig awning. She watched for his coming with heart beating quicker and quicker, as he approached, into a wild tumult of newly aroused feelings of joy and hope and fear that died away with Dane's retreating figure, leaving her tired out, as if after a struggle, sitting still for a long time in dreamy languor. Then she paddled home slowly in the afternoon, often letting her canoe float with the lazy stream in the quiet backwater of the river. The paddle hung idle in the water as she sat in the stern, one hand supporting her chin, her eyes wide open, listening intently to the whispering of her heart that seemed to swell at last into a song of extreme sweetness. Listening to that song she husked the rice at home, it dulled her ears to the shrill bickerings of Bulangi's wives, to the sound of angry reproaches addressed to herself. And when the sun was near its setting she walked to the bathing place, and heard it as she stood on the tender grass of the low bank, her robe at her feet, and looked at the reflection of her figure on the glass-like surface of the creek. Listening to it, she walked slowly back, her wet hair hanging over her shoulders. Laying down to rest under the bright stars, she closed her eyes to the murmur of the water below, of the warm wind above, to the voice of nature speaking through the faint noises of the great forest, and to the song of her own heart. She heard, but did not understand, and drank in the dreamy joy of her new existence without troubling about its meaning or its end, till the full consciousness of life came to her through pain and anger. And she suffered horribly the first time she saw Nina's long canoe drift silently past the sleeping house of Bulangi, bearing the two lovers into the white mist of the great river. Her jealousy and rage culminated into a paroxysm of physical pain that left her lying panting on the river bank, in the dumb agony of a wounded animal. But she went on moving patiently in the enchanted circle of slavery, going through her task day after day with all the pathos of the grief she could not express, even to herself, locked within her breast. She shrank from Nina as she would have shrunk from the sharp blade of a knife cutting into her flesh, but she kept on visiting the brig to feed her dumb, ignorant soul on her own despair. She saw Dane many times. He never spoke, he never looked. Could his eyes see only one woman's image? Could his ears hear only one woman's voice? He never noticed her, not once. And then he went away. She saw him, and Nina for the last time on that morning when Babalatchi, while visiting his fish baskets, had his suspicions of the white man's daughter's love affair with Dane confirmed beyond the shadow of doubt. Dane disappeared, and to Minna's heart, where lay useless, and barren the seeds of all love, and of all hate, the possibilities of all passions, and of all sacrifices, forgot its joys and its sufferings, when deprived of the help of the senses. Her half-formed, savage mind, the slave of her body as her body was the slave of another's will, forgot the faint and vague image of the ideal that had found its beginning in the physical promptings of her savage nature. She dropped back into the torpor of her former life, and found consolation, even a certain kind of happiness, in the thought that now Nina and Dane were separated, probably forever. He would forget. This thought soothed the last pangs of dying jealousy that had nothing now to feed upon, and Tamina found peace. It was like the dreary tranquility of a desert, where there is peace, only because there is no life. And now he had returned. As he had recognized his voice calling aloud in the night for Bulangi. As he had crept out after her master to listen closer to the intoxicating sound. Dane was there, in a boat, talking to Bulangi. Tamina, listening with arrested breath, heard another voice. The maddening joy, that only a second, before she thought herself incapable of containing within her fast-beating heart, died out, and left her shivering in the old anguish of physical pain that as he had suffered once before at the sight of Dane and Nina. Nina spoke now, ordering and entreating in turns, and Bulangi was refusing, expostulating, at last consenting. He went in to take a paddle from the heap lying behind the door. Outside the murmur of two voices went on. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.